Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. An editorial published in more than 200 medical journals last month warned about the risk of climate change to global public health. Hotter temperatures, weather catastrophes, disease, hunger, homelessness. The medical profession is now beginning to prepare for the potential impact. Ohio State on October 22nd is hosting its first ever symposium on the topic for medical professionals and others titled Climate Change and Health, Implications for Clinical Practice. The public can attend the event virtually. More information is available at the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. OSU Professor of Clinical Medicine, Dr. Andrew Seamus, is co-chair of the event. Welcome to the show, Dr. Seamus.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be on.
How would you say the medical establishment as a whole is responding to the health impacts or the expected health impacts of climate change?
So this is a very new thing for us in a lot of ways. There are a few physicians who've been very forward-looking. In fact, two of the keynote speakers at our conference, Dr. Jay Lemery and Dr. Aparna Bol, have been active in that space for quite some time. But and I think especially among younger physicians and students, there's a real awareness that climate change is a major issue and that we have to take it into account as practicing health professionals. But I also think we're really at the beginning of talking about this in a wider sense in the health community.
Right. I mean, there's public health and then there's personal health. Never the two shall meet until there's a pandemic and whatnot. And the pandemic has brought into stark relief the inequities of funding for public health. It's not considered a very well-funded field of practice.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I think you make a good point. I think there are certain ways in which this pandemic, although I wouldn't really say that it was caused by global warming in any direct way.
Of course.
But I think it's a sort of a trial run for what it's like to have an extended natural disaster and the way that so many systems are called upon to respond to that. And in some ways, I think we met the challenge. In other ways, I think we didn't. And so for the challenges that climate change is going to pose, I think we want to be better prepared, better coordinated. We have time to plan, but I think we do need to plan what the health system response is going to be.
And so how do you plan for something that sort of existential almost? How do you plan that? What does it look like?
Well, I think there is... I wouldn't necessarily say when you say existential that climate change is automatically a guaranteed sort of apocalypse. I think that it's sometimes talked about that this is something that we can do nothing about and it's going to lead to the end of civilization. And that, I think, is exaggerated. It depends very much on how much the climate changes. But at 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, I think we are going to see changes over the course of 20 years, 50 years, 100 years that we do have time to plan for, right? And we have some idea what those changes are going to be. We're going to see more heat waves and droughts, especially in the hotter part of the globe. There will be impacts on food and water supply. We will see more extreme weather events. We'll see coastal flooding and submersion. We'll see population displacement and migration. But those are all things that we're capable of planning for as a society if we take them seriously. And we're also very much capable at this point in history of limiting the degree of climate change and thus limiting the degree of impact.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about... The editorial was published in more than 200 medical journals last month that warned about the risk of climate change to global public health. Ohio State on October 22nd is hosting its first ever symposium on the topic for medical professionals and others. It's titled Climate Change and Health, Implications for Clinical Practice. The public can attend the event virtually. You can go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides and check that out. My guest right now is one of the co-chairs of the event, Dr. Andrew Seamus. He's a professor of clinical medicine at Ohio State. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Diseases are anticipated to change the trajectory of them. The insects that carry disease in South America, they're migrating further north. What kind of role will that play in public health, in your opinion?
Yes, I do think we need to be aware of the spread of vector-borne diseases, things like Lyme disease, for example, mosquito-borne encephalitis. You know, there are lots of insect-borne diseases. There are other diseases that are borne by other types of vectors. And so it's one of the ways in which the human health depends on the spread and the health and the, you know, what happens in the animal world. And so as animals change their distribution, the diseases carried by animals will also change. And that's one thing to be aware of. You know, I think some of the other potential human health effects over time, right, simply exposures and injuries, heat can be very dangerous. And, you know, in the warmer parts of the globe, but also in cities where there are urban heat islands, we're going to see more and more heat waves. If you look at mortality due to heat now, excess mortality, it's about 5,000 people per year. And that number has been steadily growing as the temperature warms. It's also important to recognize, if you look at heat, for example, that there's a disparate impact, right? There's good evidence that the neighborhoods that are hotter, that suffer the worst of the urban heat island effect, are the neighborhoods that were redlined from the 30s to the 50s. So often, you know, the neighborhoods with less tree cover, fewer parks, more crowded houses, more asphalt. So in many ways, the people who are most vulnerable and in society are also the people who are going to bear the greatest brunt of the impact of climate change.
There'll also be a disparate impact to a certain degree geographically, right? Some regions of the country are going to be harder hit than others. When you talk about water levels rising, those are going to be coastal issues, not, you know, the center middle of Ohio issues. Are you seeing that reflected in the interest in this among public health professionals?
Yes, right. I mean, I think one way to try to understand this is to look at how regions are going to be affected. So the West is going to be drought and fires. And I think on the news break just before this, there was a fire chief from Santa Barbara talking about a new fire. And we've all seen the pictures of these mega fires that are spreading and were unheard of, you know, 10 years ago. On the coasts, absolutely, you'll see flooding, you'll see submersion. And I think also in the West, you're going to see problems with water supply. And I think all of this ultimately, again, depending to the extent to which we can limit climate change, but it is going to lead to population displacements, right? And those things, when you have people who are suddenly or gradually displaced from where they live, that also has impacts on health systems and you know, on supply chain and on demands placed on, you know, on health systems in the places which are less affected.
And on top of all of this, because given what we've been going through for the past year and a half, we have this overlay of the threat of an increasing incidence of pandemics because of how close we are to each other. And when you talk about population displacement, it has to mean more people coming together.
Yes, I think you may see potentially more crowding in the more hospitable areas, and the Midwest may suffer fewer of the more severe effects of climate change. But we are going to see people, you know, populations moving. But if it's all right, I do want to emphasize not just the kind of the frightening effects, because I feel that, you know, sometimes that message can make people feel hopeless and powerless. And in fact, you know, in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, in order to plan a better future for ourselves, there are two basic things that need to happen. One is at the national and international level, reducing our reliance on fossil fuels and increasing renewables. But the other thing, which is maybe less talked about, is at the population and individual level, reducing our energy consumption, right? I mean, because in some ways, it's really the things we've come to rely on for transportation, for products that are driving greenhouse gas emissions. And the good news, I think, for people listening is that a lower consumption lifestyle may also be a healthier lifestyle. So the things you can do to combat climate change are also things you can do to be healthier.
Like what?
Well, for example, food production accounts for 34% of greenhouse gas emissions, which is enormous. And if you look at the ratio, you know, the amount of greenhouse gas emissions from plant-based food is half of that from animal-based food. So there's a strong environmental rationale for shifting to a more plant-based diet. But if you look at the individual impacts, there's very strong evidence of the health benefits of a plant-based diet: reduced cholesterol, reduced blood pressure, lower risk of obesity and diabetes, 16% lower cardiovascular disease, 23% lower cardiovascular mortality, a 20% reduction in all-cause mortality, stroke, cancer, all kinds of things are affected.
And that's public health's role to do that? Or do I think of it as more of a personal physician kind of a decision or conversation to be having?
I would agree with that. And it comes back to what you said. How can physicians connect with the climate crisis and communicate this to patients? And I think that is one way. There are lots of diets out there, and I know people are attached to their particular diets. I have these conversations all the time with my patients. But if you look at what the evidence is, if you look at what is really shown to increase longevity, save lives, reduce disease, a more plant-based diet has really very well-proven benefits. And I think that is a conversation that we can learn to have with our patients, both the climate impact and the individual impact.
Are you satisfied that medical schools are in on this, that medical students are being taught about these longer term issues that could affect their patients? And that includes students not in the public health field.
So very interesting question. There's a lot of competition for what goes in the medical school curriculum. They have a lot to learn. There really, as far as I know, is not a very well-developed curriculum on climate change. And even diet is really taught, I think, more in terms of surgical, post-surgical parenteral feeding as opposed to what patients should eat from day to day. One of the big drivers for putting on this conference was the medical students. As soon as they heard about it, a lot of medical students signed up. They really want to help to develop a curriculum, you know, and I think we're really lucky to have people who are so forward looking. They're looking at what the future of their profession is, and they say climate change has to be a part of medical education more than it is now.
Dr. Andrew Seamus, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciated being on.
Dr. Andrew Seamus is an associate professor in clinical medicine at Ohio State, and he's co-chair of the upcoming event. It's titled Climate Change and Health Implications for Clinical Practice, and it's for an event that's for medical professionals and others. The public can attend the event, so check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about that. And we have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The acclaimed medical journal The Lancet set off a controversy in September with the description of women as, quote, bodies with vaginas, end quote, on the front page. The blowback on social media was swift, with critics accusing the journal of sexism and of dehumanizing girls and women. The reference was just another example of medical misogyny, they said. Dr. Jennifer Grandis is a professor of otolaryngology, that is ears, nose, and throat, or head and neck, at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. She has studied gender disparity in the medical field and how that affects research, mentorships, and patient care. Her recent article for Ms. Magazine is titled, "Women in Academic Medicine Wait for Our Hashtag MeToo Moment." A link to that article is posted on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, Dr. Grandis.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here.
What's your take on the Lancet controversy? Overblown? Does it fit a pattern? It is kind of a shocking reference.
Yeah, it is. You know, I want to be really clear that I think that we are in an era of that highlights our empathy gap. You know, we as human beings have made historical assumptions about each other. And most of the time we assume everybody is like us. And I think what the Lancet issue highlighted is that the editorial board, particularly the journal editor, probably is not terribly diverse, probably doesn't include people who are non-binary or are trans. And I think that their attempt at highlighting the exhibit, and in fact, the article itself was perfectly fine. You know, it's an exhibit at the Vagina Museum in London. It really points out the stigma of periods, particularly in girls in underserved communities. There's nothing controversial about that, and the article itself was fine, but it's almost as if this was a self-inflicted wound. I mean, this editorial board decided to, I'm speculating, demonstrate how, to borrow a current term that I now use more often than I used to, woke. And what it did was it really highlighted how those choice of words in this particular context might have been a misstep. So I think it exposes this vast community in our world today, in medicine and other places, where we need to really be more open to different points of view and how something feels to someone who's very different from ourselves.
The fact of the matter is that the field of medicine, public health, all of that is still dominated primarily by white males. I mean, at the very top. It's just a fact. I mean, and it is an interesting one. You've studied gender disparity and how it affects career advancement in academic medicine. How does that play a role in all of this?
Well, thank you so much for your question. I feel like the real stark reality of medicine and science is this is a field unlike, let's say, the entertainment industry, where two things are true. Number one, we are all committed to caring. This is a healing profession. People go into science and medicine in order to make discoveries to help other people. It is not the finance industry, not that I'm denigrating any other industry, but people make a choice to sacrifice a great number of hours in their career, building in order to become skilled and qualified to take care of others. The other thing that I think is somewhat of, if you will, a myth and really highlights the crime of discrimination in science and medicine is we're supposed to be a meritocracy. We're founded upon the principles of data. We look at data, we remove emotions from data, and the data include career advancement metrics, which are supposed to be purely objective, publications, grant funding. But each and every step in the education process, in the training process, and in the career advancement process is not immune from these societal forces, particularly as you point out, when we have a lack of diversity and gender equity at the very top. So people are empowered. In my study, I found maybe a few heroes, maybe a few villains, but the overwhelming majority of men that I interviewed were perfectly reasonable human beings. They just had blind spots, like we all do as human beings. And they lived in a world where being open to their blind spots and hearing about their blind spots and doing something about their blind spots was actually discouraged, because in some ways that might undermine their power. And that's why we are stuck. And that's why I'm committed to doing something about this.
Right. That's a really interesting dynamic, that we want to trust our physicians, and that's created sort of a really interesting dynamic between patient and physician, but between society and physician too. You don't want to look vulnerable.
Right. Right. That's exactly right. I mean, having the courage to say to another human being that I don't know what to do to help you. I mean, my particular area of research is cancer. I was just at a very eminent university where I was discussing with the person who leads the palliative care program, which is care to make people comfortable, and discussing in the area of cancer how resistant, you know, physicians were to discussing hospice. So that's just one example where when we say to our patients, we no longer have any proven regimens that we think will prolong your life, feels like a failure, when indeed it really just points out the limits of modern medicine, and we can be there to help our patients not suffer.
And something as prosaic as telling your doctor, I want to have a female gynecologist do my pelvic exam instead of you, if it's a male.
Absolutely.
That can really, particularly among older doctors, I think there's an age issue going on here too, generational, I should say.
Yep. I think you're absolutely right. In fact, I had a recent conversation with a medical student, a man who said he wanted to go into OBGYN. I said, oh, tell me more, because, you know, it is now a field dominated by women practitioners because all of the patients are women. And my guess is you need to be prepared to respond to that question as you go through your interviews. And he looked at me as like he'd never considered that. I'm like, oh, no, that's really a thing.
Yeah, so things have changed outside of the profession. The question is how the profession responds to that.
Yep, that's exactly right. And I think that as long as the profession is defined by seemingly objective metrics of success, which in reality are not so objective, we are still vulnerable to all the forces that we see swirling in other arenas.
A lot of people out there who weren't paying attention were shell-shocked by the Hidden Figures film, the story of the women behind the space program. In the Ms. article, you cited examples of women such as Dr. Catalin Carrico, whose research on mRNA therapy that was used to develop the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, saving untold numbers of lives, was pretty much ignored for most of her career. Is there a legitimate parallel there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, one of the things about Hidden Figures that I heard in my interview study was from a number of women of, a mature generation training in medical schools where there were no bathrooms in the buildings where they were studying. I mean, they literally had to leave the building to find a bathroom because it was so not normal to have, you know, women in the classroom. And certainly I, as a mature surgical trainee in my era, I was the only woman in my training program. And I had to share a locker room with the nurses. And when the men that I was on rounds with would walk into the locker room to continue the conversation, I was effectively barred unless I chose to ignore the fact that it was a male locker room. But I think Dr. Carrico's story is so important, Anne, because if this pandemic has taught us anything, that science and clinicians will save our lives. They are here. We are here to help save lives and to save the world. And this woman was not in a tenure track position. She, at countless times over the course of her career, she was at risk of being booted, of not having any funding, of not having any support. And she was 100% dependent on the men with power and resources to see her and to support her. And just think of what the world would be like if she had been forced out. We talk so much about the leaky pipeline. And from my point of view, it's not a passive process. You know, women who choose to leave the profession do so because they feel profoundly undervalued and traumatized.
And they do leave it at a higher rate than men at younger. And so you've got often increasingly married couples who are both physicians or researchers, scientists. The women still will tend to leave at a higher rate than the men, for whatever reasons.
That's exactly right. And the reasons that are so commonly given as if they are truth is that, well, they get pregnant, they have children, and therefore they are pulled by their family responsibilities. But in the 54 women that I spoke with, and remember, these were all women who were still in the profession, mm-hmm. not a single one of them described their parenting responsibilities as a reason for their career frustrations and dissatisfaction. And so I just don't feel like that is really a legitimate explanation. And we provide it as if it's dogma. And you know, what was interesting in so many of my interviews with men, it was as if it was a therapeutic session for them. At the end, they said, well, what can I do about this? I'm like, talk to your female colleagues, ask them about their experiences, ask them how you make them feel. I mean, these conversations and these stories have to happen. The data and the studies alone and the policies alone are not making a difference.
Right, because the number of women in medical school has steadily increased since the 1970s. It's at parity with men, but there is a gap in advancement.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We are equal in the classroom. We are equal even at the assistant professor level. But once you get beyond the junior faculty level, the women disappear and maybe they go on to different academic tracks, but they are the less valued tracks. It's multifactorial, but the problem is that the allocation of resources, whether that be space or compensation or administrative support, is completely unregulated. It's the Wild West. It really depends on if you are lucky enough to have a patron who sees you as valuable and gives you sufficient resources for your career to proceed.
A patron, meaning some guy above you in the pecking order.
Right, because it's so rare that women are empowered to be patrons. I mean, we still have, I mean, in my field alone, only 3% of the department chairs are women, despite having equal number of women in the training programs now for about 20 years.
You've also studied how mentoring relations may reinforce or could mitigate gender inequalities in academic medicine. How so? How does that work?
Oh, thank you so much for asking about that. Yeah, it was really fascinating to look at women's and men's experiences of being mentors and of being mentored. So what we found, because mentoring relationships are private and unscrutinized, because the mentor has, you know, tremendous power over the mentee's career advancement, it was a right place for harassment and discrimination to occur. And of course, the power is so unequal. And even if institutions have, let's say, Title IX offices, the fear of retaliation and the impact that the mentor can exert on the mentee's career really overrides anybody's feeling like they can come forward and speak about it. So there, it was a really, sexual abuse is so much more common to occur in the home because it's a private place that's unscrutinized. Very similar. However, the really good news, Anne, is that when a man described having a woman mentor, they spoke so glowingly of how this woman mentor schooled them in the reality of gender discrimination and harassment in science and medicine, so that these men who were lucky enough to be mentored by a woman, they were more aware. They were, and once you're aware of it, it's easier to see it. And the same thing that is true with the mentoring relationship between a younger woman and an older man, it could be a place where the men can guide them. So and they can learn from their mentees' experiences so that they can use their power to improve the environment. So these are sacred relationships, but we've always made the assumption that they are fine if left on their own. But, you know, to borrow a line from Parenthood, you need a license to fish. You do need no criteria to be a parent. And the same is true for being a mentor. We don't have any criteria or rules or regulations about allowing someone to be a mentor or not. It really is, are they scientifically accomplished? And if they are, game on.
You know, and so there's an expectation that more women should be mentoring. It's counterintuitive in a way to say more women should be mentoring more men. Yes, more women too, but more men. It's a completely different dynamic at that point.
It is. And, you know, it's really, we have to overcome the feeling of shame when we describe our experiences of being harassed and discriminated. That stays with us a long time, and I am just as guilty of it. You know, when all of these happened to me early on, I brushed it away, I had grit, I had resilience, there was no one to speak to, but it was also humiliating, you know, to think about it, you know, exposing what had happened to me to someone else, because it raised the question, well, what did I do to invite this kind of attention or to invite this reaction? So it's so much easier to minimize and ignore. But if we do that, you know, if we don't speak our stories, even if we run the risk of suffering as a result of it, we contribute to the fact that all this behavior kind of hides in the shadows.
What, I mean, is there, I know there's no rules and regulations for this, but what about Title IX? What could their role be, the Title IX office be in an institution like, say, Ohio State or where you're at, to make sure that there is a parity up the food chain and not just in graduation time from medical school?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question, Anne. I think we have to understand all the rigorous rules and regulations wrapped around a Title IX office and recognize that it is necessary but not sufficient. So I heard several ideas during the course of my study that made a lot of sense to me. And so, for example, can there be a confidential place where people can come forward and describe their experiences and they can be recorded? So there is a record, at least. So if someone is a serial offender, it will become known over time, even if the individual is coming forward and says, no, I really don't want to go public. I really don't want to make an allegation against this individual. He has too much power over me. At least their voice has been heard. They feel supported personally. They have someone assigned to them to help them navigate the tricky waters of this career challenge. And there is a public record, because then when you go back and you're like, oh my goodness, you know, this person has a pattern of abusing their students or their trainees. And now we see the pattern. And because, you know, it's sort of like the victims shouldn't be responsible for fixing the system. And we have to recognize that this incredible discrepancy of power is an understandable disincentive for a younger victim to come forward with an allegation against a more powerful mentor.
Right. So what about proactive strategies?
Yes, very good. And so increasingly we have training. Now, this training is not mandatory. This training is elective. And of course, as we see, those people who are powerfully committed to being mentors, and unfortunately recently when I looked at it, it was overwhelmingly women who wanted to take mentorship training programs to be better mentors. I think that when someone is, you know, to be a formal mentor, you know, a graduate student mentor, a postdoc mentor, I think we need to require training. I think we need to require some sort of accountability. We need some confidential way to query the trainees about what's happening in this private, isolated setting, in order, because at the end of the day, these trainees come to an institution. Now, in the case of, you know, a graduate student lab or a postdoc lab, that relationship really almost always supersedes the institutional responsibility and affiliation, but it doesn't have to. So if an institution really sees itself, so this is the systemic force, if an institution says, it's our responsibility to recruit and retain the best talent, we want them to be scientifically and clinically productive, but we also, just as importantly, we want them to be kind, effective, and fair, and not harmful mentors. And we're going to invest in that priority. So what we have is these public statements of diversity, equity, inclusion that everybody signed up for, but really a huge gap in making that a reality.
And then just finally, to bring this back around to the everyday person who goes to physicians and trusts them and needs them for their health care, what does this mean to ordinary people, do you think?
I think for ordinary people, it means that your physicians are human, and they're just as vulnerable to societal forces as you and as I. And I think it's important to give the physician feedback. If you don't feel they're listening to you, if you don't feel that they've heard you, and don't be afraid to find a physician who you trust and have a confidence in, if the physician that you've collided with just by chance doesn't really meet your needs. Hopefully, in most communities, there are options, and it's not your job to fix your physician. It's your job to advocate for your health and make sure that you have the right partner in your physician to get you to the place where you want to be.
Dr. Jennifer Grandis, thanks so much for your time today. I wish you well and appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Jennifer Grandis is a professor of otolaryngology at the School of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and she has studied gender disparity in the medical field and how it affects career advancement in academic medicine. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The pandemic has taken its toll on frontline nurses, and this year, with classrooms back in session, school nurses have joined that front, and they are struggling. Columbus City Schools nurses last week declared a state of emergency and demanded changes, including mandatory vaccinations or testing. District Wellness Coordinator Jackie Broderick-Patton explained the problem at a news conference.
Nurses are exhausted, burnt out, and unable to complete our duties.
Kate King is president-elect of the National Association of School Nurses and school nurse at the Columbus City Schools World Language Middle School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann, so much for having me.
From a national perspective where you sit, is Columbus an isolated example?
Columbus is not an isolated example. We are hearing from school nurses across the country that their workloads are overloading, the workload is too much for them to practice nursing, their school nursing, as they used to safely, and that they're working long hours into the evening, all weekend, to add this COVID work on top of all the other things that school nurses already do.
Does it make a difference if they're from big city versus suburban and rural districts?
It really does not. Most often we find that nurses in urban settings have, or schools in urban settings have school nurses. We have to remember that only 25% of schools have a full-time nurse in the country. About another 50% have share a nurse, and 25% of schools don't have a nurse at all. And so when we're looking at that number of schools who don't have school nurse support or minimal school nurse support, it is, again, across all aspects of school nursing.
I think a lot of people have an expectation that there's a school nurse, but it's surprising to hear that it's just 25%, just one in four. And when you're talking about that, are you meaning like one in four buildings?
One in four school districts,
okay,
has a full-time nurse in every building. In different states, for example, in Massachusetts, it's a state law to have a full-time nurse in every building. And school nursing responsibilities and requirements change from state to state and even from district to district.
How is your national association working to address the concerns being raised by school nurses like in Columbus?
The first thing that the National Association of School Nurses has done is to create a COVID resource website. We have a website already, but we have a specific focus on COVID resources. So that gives school nurses an opportunity to look at the most current data and statistics, the most current quarantine and isolation protocols from the CDC. Information that they can give to their school boards, their superintendents, their principals, in order to create a safe COVID plan for their school districts. We are also, again, gathering information and listening to school nurses across the country. We're really looking at some systems change because the issue with the COVID response in schools, as well as healthcare in schools, is a systems issue. Before COVID, there weren't enough school nurses, and school nurses were working quite a lot and doing many, many tasks. One of the issues is that most people don't understand how school nurses work and what they do, and then adding COVID-19 work on top of all of that really puts school nurses in overload.
Well, let's talk about what the traditional role of a school nurse is and what it was leading up to the pandemic in early 2020.
Sure. So school nurses started way back in New York City and in response to communicable disease. In my 20 years as a school nurse, this is my 20th year as a school nurse in Columbus City Schools. When I started, we had some students with diabetes. It was rare to have a kiddo with diabetes in our school district. Now, more than 30% of children in districts have a chronic disease. The amount and the number of immunizations that are required has increased. The mental health concerns of students has greatly increased, as well as the numbers of special education students. So the expectations of a school nurse is, as always, to remove barriers to attendance in school and participation in school that involve health, to keep kids in school as much as we can, to provide case management, care coordination, public health, leadership, and quality assurance so that the school health plan in a school and the school care that the school health care that nurses provide is, again, the best possible for the student. We've just seen in my 20 years an increase in all of those chronic issues. And a school nurse also works with the outside agencies. The school nurse works with health partners. They work with the health department and basically create the whole health plan for districts.
What would a health plan be for a district besides making sure kids get their shots and, you know, taking care of them until someone can pick them up when they get a stomach ache? I mean, what is a health plan?
So a health plan for a school or a district looks at education in terms of emergency or life-threatening diseases for students. So what happens when a student has an asthma attack? What happens when a student who has diabetes is in crisis or a sickle cell crisis? That whole plan is creating individual emergency action plans for students, as well as what to do when there's a health emergency in a school. We look at CPR and AED training. We look at making sure that people are helping us or unlicensed personnel also know what they're doing with a health plan. We're looking at environmental influences in health. We're looking at screening, making sure, again, we identify children who have barriers to learning and removing those barriers, getting kids glasses, getting kids hearing aids. Across that is this quality assurance and then public health dealing with communicable diseases.
So I guess what really stands out to me in our conversation right now is this across the board increase in chronic disease among children. You're talking about asthma, diabetes, all kinds of things now.
Right. Yes. And so those diagnoses have greatly increased. And the school nurse is the person who is responsible for creating the plan of care, for making sure we get the correct medicine, for making sure parents understand what that disease process is and how we provide care in a school. It's very different to provide health care in a school than it is at home or in an acute care setting like a hospital. We have to take into consideration the educational aspects as well as the health aspects. And school nurses are experts in bridging that gap. And then we can get into mental health. Mental health crises for students is increasing as time goes on. We know that COVID has increased that. Students have lost a parent, a loved one, a caretaker, as well as just being home and isolated. And so school nurses are sentinels of mental health in school. Often mental health crises and mental health concerns manifest in physical complaints, right? Headaches, stomach aches, even sore arms sometimes, which sounds funny, but I've had kids come in with all sorts of complaints that really are their mental health issues. And so we are the ones who identify, refer, and again, garner that whole plan to wrap around that child so that child can succeed in school.
When we talk about 1 in 4 school districts across the country having a school nurse in buildings, is that an increase over time or has that been static? What's the situation there? I'm thinking about it in terms of this increase in all these other chronic conditions that school nurses grapple with. Has there been any kind of increase in staffing?
So I think we're seeing a small increase in staffing, but not a huge increase in staffing across the country with school nurses. Often schools are strapped for funding. We know that. Schools are expected to do so many things that they weren't expected to do 20 years ago. We feed children breakfast, lunch, and sometimes dinner. We provide before and after care. School nurses are sometimes the only healthcare provider a student sees. And so we are the unpaid through any insurance or very little with insurance, the healthcare system or the hidden healthcare system. And when schools are strapped for money, and we know that this is a system problem across the country, that school systems are not funded adequately for many things they do, often school nurses or the healthcare are the first area to get cut. Because often, again, I think that people don't understand the importance of what school nurses do and that they do that.
I know there's a movement afoot to actually put clinics in, particularly elementary schools, kind of as that first line of defense. And I don't know if there's any schools in Columbus that do that, that have regular clinical hours that give kids access to regular health care.
So we have a great partnership with Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus City Schools. We have 11 schools with a school-based health center.
Okay.
But I want to be clear, that's not school nursing. School-based health centers are acute, episodic, or chronic care in a school.
But it does reduce the pressure on school nurses to kind of be a catch-all, though, right?
It does not. Gives us, I'm going to say it in this way, and it gives us a resource in the school to refer students.
Okay, gotcha.
So we can send a student down the hall to get care rather than their parent missing work and picking them up. Mm-hmm. And we do collaborate and work together. And yet the practice of school nursing is different and separate from a practice of a school-based health center.
And the teaching function of this, I kind of wondered when you said it's also your responsibility to teach, you know, parents how to cope with some of these chronic diseases that their children live with. Why is that your job to do that?
Well,
But I'm just wondering why. Why don't parents get that from the family doctor kind of a thing?
Well, first of all, care changes over time. And again, implementing healthcare in a school is different than what the family doctor may have talked about or the discharge. And parents need to hear things over and over and over. You know, when your kiddo has a chronic disease and you're hearing that, you're probably hearing every third word. And even when you go back, you're not hearing it. You're hearing it with not a health provider's ear. And our job, again, is to help parents navigate that system, because even navigating the healthcare system is difficult. And it's difficult for nurses, much less many of our families who are very much afraid of the healthcare system. They feel patronized by the healthcare system, and they just don't know to speak up. And when the parent doesn't understand, when the parent needs help with that, that's a barrier, because if those children aren't getting the care that they need, then they're going to be sick and they're not going to come to school.
I didn't mean to leave it till the last minute. We only have about a minute left, but I wanted to talk about the impact on the job of a school nurse when it comes to homeless students and also transient students that are in and out of different buildings all the time.
So that is difficult. You know, we work really closely with Project Connect, the McKinney-Vento Act, which allows students to stay in their home school when, in fact, they are homeless. We, again, have some difficult times getting them to appointments, making sure they follow up with appointments, and, again, contacting parents. If you're living in a shelter and don't have a phone, it's hard for us to communicate with parents. And, again, we really focus greatly on those students who are transient. And in our system, we have a great network. We have, of course, our computer systems, but we have a website just for nurses, so we can coordinate care when a student moves from one school to another.
Wow. Kate King, I'm exhausted just listening to everything school nurses do, but I do thank you for your work and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Anne. It was a pleasure to be here.
Kate King is a school nurse at World Language Middle School in Columbus City School District, and she's also president-elect of the National Association of School Nurses. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today, so thanks for your attention. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.